From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Defense attorneys for the accused Wolverine Watchmen say jurors will need specifics to back up prosecutors' claims.
Their job is not to assess what a government informant wants them to do. It's to assess the accused intent and what they actually plan on doing.
Then we dig into the history of the Affordable Care Act and what it could mean going forward.
If President Trump is reelected with a Republican-led Congress, then it's very likely they would turn to the states and encourage them to come up with more state-led solutions.
Plus, what happened when the ACLU notified Michigan voters their absentee ballots were rejected?
Initially, I was extremely disappointed. I put a lot of work into researching the candidates, and I really felt I had done my due diligence as a voter.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, what happens when your mail-in ballot gets rejected? Clerks will notify you for some problems, but not all of them. So the ACLU is stepping in with a notification service.
We are better served by just notifying voters when this happened, no matter what the reason is, no matter why, because they have a right to know if their ballot was rejected.
Also, some things you can do to make sure your ballot doesn't get rejected. That's in the second half of today's show. But first, five of the 13 men charged in the alleged plot to kidnap the governor were in federal court yesterday. The official question on the docket was whether these men could be released from detention to await their trial. The judge decided that three of the men cannot, and she's expecting to hear from two others on Friday. In making their case during the hearing, prosecutors revealed many more details about the alleged plot. Here to tell us what we've learned is Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer. Hey, Dustin.
Hey, April.
So you went to this hearing yesterday. Can you just sort of set the scene for us? Tell us what it was like in court.
Yeah, this is a U.S. federal court in downtown Grand Rapids. The courtroom itself, it's a large wood-paneled courtroom, a lot of space in there, and U.S. Marshals brought in the five defendants. So in this case, it wasn't just one person who was a defendant. There's five defendants. There's one other defendant, Barry Croft, who's based out of Delaware. He was not there. But these five men came in, and they were wearing street clothes, a lot of them in jeans, and their hands were cuffed in front of them. Each of them were taking small steps toward their seats because there were also chains around their ankles. And there were family members in the audience. Sometimes they would try to make eye contact with some of the men, although the men were mostly silent. And there were prosecutors from the U.S. Attorney's Office. An FBI special agent was there to testify. And basically for 4 hours throughout the morning, they went over in detail every step of the alleged plot.
This case has gotten, obviously, a lot of coverage since the indictment was first revealed last Thursday. What did you hear yesterday that was new?
Yeah, we knew a lot, and now we know a lot more. We learned yesterday that the Michigan governor, Gretchen Whitmer, she wasn't the only potential target for these guys. At least early on in the plot, the men also discussed possibly targeting Virginia's governor, Ralph Northam. We learned that once they decided to focus on Whitmer and they honed this sort of scheme that they had, their plan was to kidnap Whitmer, take her in a boat to the middle of Lake Michigan, and just leave her there. And we learned more about their plan to kill police. That wasn't just necessarily a side issue for them. One of the men, one of the defendants named Brandon Caserta, prosecutors showed a video of him calling police the enemy, and he said he wanted to kill as many police as he could. We learned that some of the men originally at least met online and that federal government served a subpoena to Facebook to get access to their communications. Mm. And that when the men moved to encrypted apps to try to avoid detection, even that was able to be picked up by the FBI because the FBI had an informant on the inside who captured screenshots of all of their messages, who kept the photos, who downloaded all the videos. And it wasn't just one informant. There were actually two informants and two undercover FBI agents who helped gather information on these men along the way.
Yeah, it sounds like the discovery phase of this is going to be pretty intense. Dustin, let's talk a little bit more about this. The use of informants has been an issue in some other cases involving alleged terrorist plots. Is there anything that we know yet about the informants who worked on this case and what their role was?
We don't know a whole lot yet, but we know that it's going to be a huge part of the defense for these five men and probably for a lot of the others, the total of 13 men who've been charged. The defense attorneys were trying to say yesterday in court that all of the evidence that's been presented, it's really just talk. One of the attorneys called it, quote, big talk between crackpots. So we know that there were two confidential informants inside this plot and two undercover agents, a total of four people informing on this group. We know that one of the undercover agents was essentially hired to be their explosives guy, the person who was going to, you know, potentially sell them the explosives that they would use to take out a bridge in northern Michigan. But we don't know a ton about the confidential informants. One of the defense attorneys tried to argue in court yesterday that at least one of these informants wasn't just sort of a participant in this group, that this informant was actually a leader in the group and was pushing a lot of the conversation, a lot of the ideas along. And we don't have a lot of evidence on that yet. But like you said, there's going to be a lot of materials that defense attorneys are going to be reviewing and a lot of statements and actions by this informant that they're going to be scrutinizing pretty closely. And we did hear from one of the attorneys on this outside of court. This attorney, his name is Gary Springstead. He represents the defendant, Ty Garbin. He spoke to reporters outside the courthouse yesterday.
The court and the government and the defense attorneys have to be leery of that because their job is not to assess what a government informant wants them to do. It's to assess the accused's intent and what they actually plan on doing.
And as we said, there's a ton of evidence. At one point, the FBI special agent, Richard Trask, said to one of the defense attorneys, it's possible there's 100 hours of audio recordings that haven't even really been gone over yet. So all of that is going to have to be examined. The defense attorneys will take a very close listen to it, and we will find out later in this case.
Dustin, just real briefly, it sounds like three of the defendants were not released on bond. Is that correct?
That's correct. Out of the there's 13 men total who have been charged, six of them in federal court, seven in state court. Yesterday, five of the federal defendants were in court, but only three of them had bond hearings. Of those three, all three were denied bond, which means they will be held by the U.S. Marshals at least until any trial would begin.
Is there anything you can tell us about the reasoning? Were they considered flight risks or possibly of some danger to the public?
Well, that was really the main subject of the hearing, and the judge went over that in a lot of detail because there's really only two reasons that a person could be held without bond before a trial. And the first is the possibility of a flight risk, and basically the magistrate judge in this case, she dismissed that. She said she didn't think there was a huge flight risk. These men, at least these five, were all from Michigan. She didn't think they would run. She said the bigger concern is that she thought they would be potentially risky to the public, that they wouldn't be safe. And she said in the case of, as I mentioned earlier, Brandon Caserta, who said he wanted to kill police officers, she said, you know, I can't assign a probation officer to this person who's threatened to kill police officers. I can't put a law enforcement officer in that position. So her reasoning was that it was just too much of a risk and that these men needed to remain behind bars, remain in U.S. Marshals custody. Two of the other men, that would be Adam Fox and Ty Garbin, they will have bond hearings, I think, later this week.
Dustin, is there anything you can tell us about who's on the defense team?
Well, we heard from Gary Springstead. He's been hired by Ty Garbin. Gary told me that also his co-counsel is a defense attorney who also worked on the Houtari militia case. That's a case that goes back about 10 years. There were members of a militia group who allegedly plotted to kill police officers, but charges against those men were ultimately dropped. And Springstead told me that the attorney that secured that for the defendants is also now working on this case. But for the other defendants in the case, they're actually being represented by court-appointed attorneys. Their income qualifies them for court-appointed attorneys, which is an interesting dynamic if you think about it, because all day yesterday, they were presenting evidence in court of these men declaring the government the enemy of the people, and one of them saying they were being enslaved by the state. And now here they are in court being defended by court-appointed attorneys paid for by the state.
What do we know about how long this whole process might take?
We know that federal cases can sometimes take a long, long time. As I mentioned before, there are two different tracks going here. There are the state cases, and then there are the federal cases. Federal cases can take a lot longer. We're only really in the pretrial and the bond phase for these two men. Once that's clear and once the judge has determined, yes, there is enough evidence for this to go to trial, and you know, they'll have to answer that question. But even once they do, it could be months. It could be well into 2021 before there is a trial to really determine the guilt or innocence of these men.
What will you be keeping an eye on between now and then?
I'm definitely curious about how much evidence will be released through the discovery process, how much defense attorneys will tell us about what they're hearing in the rest of these recordings. They have hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of recordings of these men discussing their plot. And the other thing I'll be watching very closely is whether we find out any more charges, or whether there are any other people who share similar views, any other people who might have similar ideas about the government and about taking action against the government. You know, one of the concerns at the bond hearing about releasing these men is that there might still be other people out there who would help these men and who would possibly come up with another conspiracy to try to overtake the government or kidnap a governor or any of a number of violent actions that could happen.
Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer. Dustin, thanks.
Thank you.
It feels like Michigan's political fault lines got a hard shake from the kidnapping charges. Is this case changing how you view the public sphere at all? Are you feeling any different about the things you say in public? What do you make of the charges? We always enjoy hearing from you. If you want to email us, the address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave some comments on Michigan Radio's Facebook page, and you can tweet at us, too. Our handle is @statesideradio. With so many of our autumn traditions gone out the window this year, many of us big Halloween geeks are trying to figure out what to do with ourselves in October. Here's an idea. Bedtime Stories with Alice Cooper. Alice, that proud man of Detroit, is doing a fundraiser next week for North Star Reach, a medical camp for kids with significant health issues. For this event, 10 lucky families will join online for a spooky story time with Alice, the original architect of Shock Rock. He says he's, surprise, a big fan of Halloween. He's going to read about spiders and spirits, goblins and ghosts, monsters and mutants. This whole thing will be online later, but only these 10 families who pay up front will get to participate in the recording. Guys, Alice Cooper says he's going to keep it appropriate for kids 6 and older. Would you let your kid hear bedtime stories with Alice Cooper? Sounds to me like a recipe for night terrors.
Welcome to my breakdown. I hope I didn't scare you. That's just the way we are when we come down.
Next up, what we've learned from 10 years of the Affordable Care Act and from the past 8 months.
The pandemic has unmasked how important health insurance coverage is to Americans of all ages and all backgrounds. Because it's so unpredictable when someone might become ill or injured.
What do these lessons tell us about charting the way ahead? Will it matter if the Supreme Court strikes down the ACA? More on that in a moment. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This fall, the United States Supreme Court will hear a case that could determine whether the tentpoles of the Affordable Care Act will stand. States are suing to overturn Obamacare. And if they are successful, they would be allowed to walk away from some of the policy's core functions, including mandatory coverage for pre-existing conditions. No doubt you've heard a bit about this in the run-up to Judge Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings for her nomination to the Supreme Court. We were curious about what else a Supreme Court ruling might change. This week, the University of Michigan is hosting a virtual conversation to pull some of these threads. Among the participants, a voice you know well, Dr. Howard Markell, director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan and a frequent commentator on Stateside. Howard, good to hear from you.
Great to be here, April.
And we're also joined today by Dr. John Ayanian, director of the Institute of Healthcare Policy and Innovation at the University of Michigan. He's taking part as well. John Ayanian, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
John, will you remind us about the nature of the case before the High Court this fall and just who brought the challenge?
So a number of state attorneys general in Republican-led states around the country have gone through the federal court system to once again challenge the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. In 2017, when President Trump and the Republican-led Congress eliminated the tax penalty for the individual mandate, that raised a question of whether the Affordable Care Act remained constitutional, because in the original challenge to the case in 2012, Chief Justice John Roberts had determined that it was that tax penalty that gave Congress the power to have an individual mandate, and that the Affordable Care Act as a whole rested on that decision. So now we have a number, over a dozen Republican state attorneys general who are challenging the law. And on the other side, we have a number of Democratic state attorneys general who are seeking to defend it before the Supreme Court.
If the Affordable Care Act is overturned by the Supreme Court, what course of action might Congress pursue, assuming that there is the will to pick up the ball with this again?
It very much depends on the results of the presidential and congressional election that we'll all be participating in come November 3rd. If President Trump is reelected with a Republican-led Congress, then it's very likely they would turn to the states and encourage them to come up with more state-led solutions for what should come next after the Affordable Care Act. Whereas if the Affordable Care Act is overturned and Vice President Joe Biden is elected with a Democratic-led Congress, there would be an opportunity actually for an even stronger federal response to healthcare reform in the United States, either building on the Affordable Care Act and fixing some of the problems that are being challenged right now, such as the lack of the tax penalty, or coming up with a stronger response, which some in the Democratic Party are advocating for Medicare for All. So it very much depends on the results of this upcoming election, what will come next if the Supreme Court were to overturn the Affordable Care Act.
John Iannian, when you think about the shifts in healthcare policy over the decades, how big a watershed was the Affordable Care Act?
In many ways, it's the most important reform to our healthcare system since the creation of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965. At the time the Affordable Care Act was enacted in 2010, we had nearly 50 million Americans who were uninsured, and that had been a longstanding problem for over a decade. And with the Affordable Care Act, we've seen over 20 million Americans gain insurance coverage, mainly through the expansion of Medicaid, such as the Healthy Michigan Plan here in Michigan, as well as the creation of the Affordable Care Act marketplaces, which provide subsidized private insurance to middle-income Americans and their families who don't have access to health insurance through their employers.
Howard Markel, a decade now after it's become law, is there anything you would add about how the ACA has changed healthcare in America?
Well, as John has so cogently said, we had this longstanding, not only problem, but huge expense of 50 million Americans not being insured. And that's been cut roughly in half or a little bit less than that. And I think we have a long way to go with those who remain uninsured. But this has been a battle that has been argued and rejected or approved since Teddy Roosevelt was running for president as a third party ticket, the Bull Moose ticket in 1912. Woodrow Wilson won that election, by the way. It came up in 1917. It came up in the 30s with the Social Security Act, but FDR had to remove the health care issues to pass Social Security. Harry Truman proposed it. And of course, Lyndon Johnson came up with a compromise for Medicare for the elderly, Medicaid for the poor, and the hope that the employer insurance would cover up the middle. We've since found that that is simply not enough. What my hope is that we will continue to build on this issue with the very clear notion that every American has a right to health and health care.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Howard Markel of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan and Dr. John Iannian, Director of the Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation at the U of M. All this as a virtual conversation is in the works this week to talk about the ACA, its history, and its future. Gentlemen, the ACA and the repeal of Obamacare, as it was put at the time, was not a small part of the Tea Party movement and the strength of the movement and the midterm victories that the Republican Party was able to achieve in the midst of the Obama administration. As time went on, it became clear that many voters didn't want to go back to the way things were, and that the ACA had opened up some possibilities that many Americans would be afraid to lose. There was the shift of Democrats winning elections on the strength of keeping health care reforms in place. At this point, do you see any political points to be won in getting rid of some or all of the ACA? John, what's your read on that?
Well, there was one part of the Affordable Care Act that was unpopular. That was the individual mandate. And the tax bill passed by Congress at the end of 2017 eliminated the financial penalty that went with that, really sort of taking away the harshest component of that individual mandate, which many people on both sides of the aisle had problems with. But there are other provisions of the Affordable Care Act that have turned out to be extremely popular, such as Medicaid expansion, such as subsidies for private insurance through the marketplaces, the ability for young adults to stay on their family health insurance plans, and even some parts that aren't as well known, such as improving the Medicare Part D drug benefit for Medicare beneficiaries. All of those have been very popular, and I think that's why when there was a chance that the Affordable Care Act could be fully eliminated by Congress in 2017, and then voters had a chance to weigh in during the 2018 midterm elections, you saw a very strong support for retaining most provisions of the Affordable Care Act. And now we have another election in just a few weeks, and it will be important to see how voters take a stand at this point when so much is on the line with the future of the ACA.
You don't get very far in healthcare policy if you don't have at least some cooperation from healthcare providers and insurance providers. John Iannian, what positions has the industry staked out that you think they will absolutely stand by? Where is their line in the sand on future changes to ACA?
Well, as Howard indicated, most major physicians, professional organizations have now taken a strong stand in favor of the Affordable Care Act, in favor of expanding insurance coverage to all Americans. Even some traditionally organizations that often opposed healthcare reform and expanded coverage in the past have now taken a stronger stand. And the insurance industry agreed to a series of compromises with the Affordable Care Act. So they accepted some of the protections for pre-existing conditions in return for subsidies and encouraging everyone to sign up for coverage when they were eligible. So my sense right now is that most healthcare providers and major insurers are supportive of the Affordable Care Act and don't want to go back to the system we had before the ACA was enacted in 2010.
Do you see stakeholders reacting in part to the pandemic, or are these positions that they either had taken before or would have taken in any regard?
I would say most of these positions were established before COVID-19 and the pandemic hit our society. But the pandemic has unmasked how important health insurance coverage is to Americans of all ages and all backgrounds. Because it's so unpredictable when someone might become ill or injured, and having good health insurance coverage gives them access to the effective medical care they need for COVID-19, as well as a range of other conditions.
Howard Markel, I feel like I have seen a bit more messaging around the ACA, perhaps in anticipation of Judge Barrett's confirmation hearings, or perhaps as a way to talk to voters who were on the fence about what they should be paying attention to with the top of the ticket races. But are you surprised the ACA hasn't been more at the forefront of the national dialogue in a presidential election year?
Well, you know, if you listen to Joe Biden's speeches, and it's certainly if you look at his commercials, health is really at the forefront of his platform. The mere fact that he wears a mask, something that President Trump mocked him for before contracting COVID himself, I think is a sign of this. And as John was saying, there was a movement, or really an enjoyment, if you will, of these benefits by most Americans. It's very similar, by the way, to Social Security in 1935-36. The Republican Party fought it tooth and nail, and for many years after, until most Americans, particularly elderly, realized they liked Social Security benefits. And I think we're seeing the same thing with ACA. And of course, we've seen this with Medicare, Medicaid. If you listened to yesterday's political theater, or I should say confirmation hearings of Judge Amy Coney Barrett, the Democratic speeches or opening remarks were almost exclusively about the Affordable Care Act, including photographs and stories about people from each senator's state that benefited from the ACA and would be really up the creek, particularly with COVID-19, if they did not have that health care insurance. To counter that, the Republican opening speeches were all about, I think we should focus on the on confirming the candidate here or the nominee rather than talk about the Affordable Care Act. So I think if you're listening, that's the key. If you're listening, you're hearing a great deal about the Affordable Care Act and its future, which really does depend, I think, more on less on what the Supreme Court may do in a few weeks and far more on how the election pans out on November 3rd.
John Iannian, is there a short answer for what sort of patients the Affordable Care Act made the most impact on?
Yes, it's clear that it had the most impact and generally in a positive way for those with chronic conditions, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, or with risks for conditions where we know healthcare matters, such as breast cancer or colon cancer. Those are the groups who clearly benefited from the access to primary care, the improved access to affordable medications that the ACA provides, and where we see benefits. And then there are some other groups that we're beginning to appreciate more, such as those with mental health conditions or with problems with opioid disorders, dependence on opioids. Clearly, the expansion of Medicaid has improved the safety net for people with those conditions, as has the availability of affordable marketplace coverage through the ACA.
It feels like people at the top of the economic ladder have been able to either afford their own health care or secure jobs where they could get reasonable health care. People on the very bottom of the economic spectrum have some access to care through Medicaid. It seems like one of the problem areas that American policy has always had to deal with has been folks in the middle, working people, people who own their own small businesses and have to purchase their own health care. Is that a correct read?
That's certainly a fair summary. Yes, and that's the group that tends to be squeezed the hardest by rising health care costs. And fitting those into their budgets, especially if anyone in their family has a major health condition, which is not always expected or predictable.
So how does that track with who has either the most decision-making power in the political process or who has the most electoral power?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. But I mean, to me, the real power on this issue is the voters, and they have a real decision to make on November 3rd, because each presidential candidate has a very different view. President Trump, of course, has tried repeatedly to repeal the Affordable Care Act and speaks in very hyperbolic and inaccurate terms of its use, or as he calls it, its failure. And Biden's plan is far more to fix what is wrong with the Affordable Care Act, both legalistically and in terms of its process. But you know, this represents your definition of the middle being left out represents the great failure of the Medicaid Medicare Act of 1965, because at that time healthcare insurance was relatively cheap, and what the medical enterprise could do for its patients was far more limited and far more affordable than today, with all the bells and whistles and wonderful cures and treatments we have at present.
So if there had been a time for reform, it would have been at that point.
Exactly. But the thought was that employed Americans would get their health insurance from their employer, and employers, particularly for unionized workers, thought, well, that's a reasonable thing to throw in because it wasn't really all that expensive. And that was the time. Another time was when the Social Security Act was passed. But it was clear from the opposition, from the right, the Republican Party, that that terrible term, socialized medicine, which, you know, if you're on Medicare or Medicaid, you know, you are getting that in a sense. But he felt that there was no way the Social Security Act would pass. So he took that clause out. It's going to take a lot of courage, a lot of gumption, and a lot of support. And my read on the American people, and I'm sure Dr. Ayanian would agree, is that most Americans are content with the Affordable Care Act and want it to continue. If they do, they have a chance to voice their opinion on November 3rd.
Dr. Howard Markell is director of the Center for the History of Medicine at the University of Michigan. And we've also heard today from Dr. John Ayanian, director of the Institute for Healthcare Policy and Innovation at the U of M. And they will be part of a virtual free event tomorrow, October 15th. If you're hungry for more conversation on this, you can hear and interact with a panel of experts from all across the country. Howard, John, thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you, April.
Thank you.
Are you still puzzling over this year's state ballot initiatives? We have some background for you coming up, including information on Michigan's profits from oil and gas production on public lands.
It's been doing that for many, many years now. The difference is where the money goes, when it goes there, and whether the legislature ever gets its hands on it.
That's next after we do a short break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Between November 2018 and August 2020, 35,000 people thought they had voted in elections held in Michigan, but their absentee ballots had actually been rejected.
My name is Colleen Vlahos, and I'm from Farmington Hills, Michigan. When I was opening my mail this past Friday, I had a letter from the Michigan ACLU notifying me that a ballot of mine within the last 2 years had been rejected. And since I've only voted absentee in the August primary, I knew that that was the one that had been rejected. I am fortunate to have a sister who's very well versed in the voting process, and I enlisted her help, and she was able to help me find out that it was rejected because it was not received on time. Initially, I was extremely disappointed. I put a lot of work into researching the candidates, and I really felt I had done my due diligence as a voter. And so I was just definitely disappointed to find out that my vote hadn't counted.
Now, there are some issues that clerks will call you about, like if you forget to sign your ballot envelope. But for other issues, you may never know. The ACLU of Michigan recently did a major outreach to those 35,000 voters whose ballots were rejected. And here to talk some more about that process is Sharon Delente, voting rights strategist for the ACLU of Michigan. Sharon, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sharon, can you remind us some of the reasons that a ballot might get rejected, like what happened to Colleen Vlahos, who we heard from earlier?
Well, the ACLU of Michigan has been tracking and monitoring the rejection of absentee ballots since Proposal 3 passed in 2018. We knew, of course, that many more people would be choosing to vote by absentee ballot. And in this year of the pandemic, that has been even more volume of voters choosing that option. And we wanted to make sure we were monitoring how many folks were having their ballot rejected and what the reason was. So the number one reason over the elections that we've been monitoring is that the ballot is not received by the deadline. Mm-hmm. Mostly that is because voters have perhaps a different understanding of how long it takes mail to get from point A to point B in their local city or township. So the Postal Service says that it'll take 1 to 3 days. With the challenges of the pandemic this year and the attacks on the Postal Service, that started to increase in the August primary, and therefore we saw more voters whose ballots did not arrive by the deadline.
Hopefully we're all getting a bit more education about this now, at least as the subject has been more widely discussed. People have for some time been able to check whether their application to vote absentee was received. You can find out whether your ballot was mailed, whether your ballot was received by a clerk's office. But until recently, we weren't able to know if our ballots had been accepted or rejected. What changed that? Was that a Prop 3 thing?
No, it wasn't Proposal 3, but it was something that the ACLU has been urging the Department of State to put on their website where you can find out that information that you just described. Knowing that the information about a rejected ballot is recorded, there's a record of that, and that that is in a database election officials in Michigan use, we urge the Department of State to make that information visible on their website. Because for voters who are being encouraged in this year to check on the status of their application or ballot, we knew it would be another way that voters could be informed if there was any problem.
What is the backstory on why it is that local clerks are not required to notify voters when an absentee ballot has been rejected?
So with the passage of Senate Bill 757 last week, which was signed into law by the governor, clerks are now legally required to notify voters when there is a signature issue. So the second most common reason that a voter would have a ballot rejected is they forgot to sign it. And then a much less common reason is that the signature did not match the signature on file. So as to both of those cases, Michigan law now requires city and township clerks to notify a voter within 48 hours. But I do want to note that the ACLU of Michigan did an investigation into this about a year ago, and the practice of many clerks was already to notify voters who had a signature problem. I think the more difficult and challenging issue is when voters' ballots arrive after the deadline, because in that instance, there is not a legal requirement and there has not been a practice at the state or the local level. And quite frankly, if the ballot arrives after the deadline, the voter can't remedy that. So it perhaps doesn't seem like the most useful thing to do. I take a different view. I think that if your ballot arrived after the deadline, it's critically important to notify the voter so that they just don't have that problem again in the future.
Right. I can imagine that only happens once when you alert people to the issue.
Right. Yes. You know, what we've also seen over the course of this year is a tremendous amount of additional opportunities for voters to return their ballots in other ways, not just the mail. So the mail still exists, and we encourage voters, if they want to use the mail, to return that ballot by mail by October 20th. But right now, and even, you know, all the way up until Election Day, voters know and are now getting a lot of education and encouragement to return their ballot in person, to return their ballot at a secure drop box, and so to use these other available methods in addition to the mail.
I wanted to ask what it says about Michigan's capabilities for processing absentee ballots that it fell to the ACLU to start notifying people that your ballot in recent years may have been rejected.
I think local election officials are doing their best to ensure that every vote is counted in each election. And I think, you know, there are a variety of reasons. There are other reasons that we have not spoken of for which a person's ballot is rejected, that there's nothing that can be done, and that, while sad, is just reality. So, for example, if a voter passes away, if a voter submits their absentee ballot and then they pass away, their ballot is rejected. Obviously, in that instance, there's no need for the voter to be notified. And in fact, it would not be, you know, helpful to notify the family. My position would be that, except for those instances like where the voter has passed away, we are better served by just notifying voters when this happened, no matter what the reason is, no matter why, because they have a right to know if their ballot was rejected.
So as voters either head into the polls this November or get ready to send in those absentee ballots, what do you think are the most important things that they ought to keep in mind?
I just want them to know that they shouldn't be afraid. They should just know the simple steps that they need to take, which is, number one, to make sure to sign the outside of their absentee ballot envelope, to use their official signature, the one that they use on important documents and not at the grocery store when you're signing on one of those signature pads, and that to get that ballot back to your city or township clerk
as soon as possible. If you want to mail it, you should do that by October 20th. Otherwise, drop it off. You can also, if you can't mail it and don't have time and you can't for whatever reason, you know, perhaps physically or transportation, you're not able to deliver it, you can also call your city or township clerk and ask them to send a staff member to come and pick it up. So
wait, that's a thing?
That is a thing. So up until Friday at 5 p.m. before an election, if you cannot return your ballot by mail, and you cannot, perhaps you don't have transportation or a voters with a disability or an illness or some other barrier, you can call your city or township clerk and they are required to provide assistance. And that could be the clerk themselves or a staff member with credentials who comes and picks up the ballot from you. Family members and those living in your household could also return your ballot for you. Immediate family members or someone living in your household could also return it for you.
Sharon Delente is voting rights strategist for the ACLU of Michigan. Sharon, thanks for talking to us about this.
Thank you, April.
While voting has been underway for a couple of weeks now, you may not have a lot of information about some of this year's down-ballot issue campaigns. I mean, compared with what was up for a vote in 2018, including marijuana legalization and no reason absentee ballots, this year's looks kind of tame. But there are still some important issues to decide. Michigan Radio's Lester Graham published a couple of articles recently to help us sort through this, and he joins us now. Hey, Lester.
Hi, April.
Let's start out with Proposition 1. This concerns revenue from oil and gas production off Michigan's public lands. First of all,
we're going to start with the hard one first, huh?
Right. Can you tell us who preferred this one to the ballot?
Well, this one, like Prop 2, both referred to the ballot by the legislature, and it was approved unanimously, which, you know, anything bipartisan coming out of the legislature is pretty interesting these mm-hmm. days. So it has that going for it. This proposal is, though, pretty complex, and I've gotten more questions from people about this one. And even when I started looking into it, I found it to be really confusing. So we'll do our best today to try to clear this up.
For sure. Well, the top line, I guess you'd say, is this ballot proposal says that revenues from oil and natural gas production on Michigan's public lands should be funneled back into support for the natural spaces in the state. First of all, go ahead.
It's been doing that for many, many years now. The difference is where the money goes, when it goes there, and whether the legislature ever gets its hands on it.
So fossil fuel production is happening on public lands in the modern era, correct?
Right, yeah. We've got a lot of gas drilling, some oil drilling, some mineral extraction, and royalties from those payments, if they're done on, if any of the extraction is done on public land, goes to the state, and it goes into one of two funds, the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund or the Michigan State Parks Endowment Fund. Now, the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund reached its cap of $500 million about 9 years ago, and money's been going to the Michigan State Parks Endowment Fund. Both of those are used for, you know, parks and acquiring land for conservation and making recreational areas.
So is there an expectation that there will be more such oil and gas production in the future? Is that why this is on the ballot right now?
Yeah, the idea is that it will continue. We don't know with the shift from fossil fuels how much longer it will continue, but the idea is it's going to continue for a while. And here's what happens. Right now, all that money is going into the Michigan State Parks Endowment Fund because there's the cap on the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund. That Michigan State Parks Endowment Fund is going to have a cap or has a cap of $800 million. After both of them were fully funded like that so that they would live off the earnings and interest of those funds, then the legislature, as it stands now, could use the money to do whatever they wanted to meet other budgetary requirements. If this proposal is passed, the cap for the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund disappears. It becomes unlimited. And as soon as the Michigan State Parks Endowment Fund reaches its cap of $800 million, all of the money from the oil and gas royalties would go to the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund.
So I know from reading your article that some environmental groups support this and some are in opposition. Can you lay out for us what defines the split?
Yeah, it's fairly simple. Most of the Michigan environmental groups, as well as a lot of business groups and even the Michigan Oil and Gas Association, which makes some people suspicious, are in favor of passing Proposal 1. However, the Sierra Club, the Michigan chapter of the Sierra Club, does not like it because they think it takes the emphasis away from land purchases and puts it in to buying facilities or building facilities and operations. They also say that we're taking a finite resource, this oil and gas, and using it for operations is not a good idea. That should be something that is paid for out of the general fund. And finally, they're concerned that if we rely on this exclusively for both land acquisition and for operations and facilities, that might push or might motivate the state to allow more leasing and more drilling on public lands for funding. It's not clear that that would happen. There's also a big question about the timeline, because in that Michigan State Parks Endowment Fund, there are $273 million there now. And getting to $800 million to its cap is going to take anywhere from 10 to 30 years. And at that point, then all that money is supposed to go into the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund. But we don't know if there's going to be that much drilling by that point.
Well, let's move on to Prop 2. This is a constitutional amendment concerning the circumstances under which our law enforcement can search our electronic devices. Who referred this one?
This was also referred by the legislature, also unanimously. This is something that's been talked about for a very long time. So there are these devices that the police can use that will capture the data on your cell phone or on your tablet. It could be as simple as a traffic stop. They ask to see your phone. You say, oh, okay, and they take it, and they take all the data, all your communications, all the history of your phone calls and everything else, and get it on this device. That, to some people, said, hey, look, that's illegal search and seizure, so we really ought to put some rules around this. Now, the ACLU, back in 2008, asked the state police, because they were using it, hey, we want to know exactly what's going on here. What kind of data and how often are you using this? And the state police told the ACLU, well, fine, we will fulfill the FOIA request, but it will cost $544,680 to do that.
Yikes!
Which raised a lot of concern. And so anyway, in the next 9 or 10 years, there have been a lot of concerns, both by everybody from the Mackinac Policy Center to the ACLU, about this idea that this data is being taken. So what Prop 2 would say, you cannot take this data from a cell phone or from a tablet without getting a search warrant. It's just like if they were coming into your home and doing search and seizure, they'd have to have a search warrant. So that's what this does. Now, the state police have defended their actions, saying in the past that, look, we always got a search warrant when it was important, and we only used that equipment when something really bad had happened. So this basically says, yeah, no, there are no excuses. You will always get a search warrant. All law enforcement will have to get a search warrant before they do this, because other agencies have been able to use it. And frankly, the two major agencies, the Michigan State Police being the primary among them, are both in favor of this. So I know of no opposition to Proposal 2. Everybody seems to think it's a good idea that law enforcement gets a search warrant before they start taking data away off of your phone or your tablet.
You know, it's kind of interesting that this got referred as a constitutional amendment. Is there,
by the legislature, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, considering that there's even some support from law enforcement about this, do you get any sense about how much it's needed?
Well, I don't know, as far as an amendment, it's a safeguard, really, because we've got U.S. constitutional protections, but it's a little vague on electronic data, and it needs a lot more time through the courts to kind of solidify this whole idea of electronic data. And the state of Michigan, the legislature believes, and a lot of other people believe within the state, that why take the chance, why take the risk, or why wait for the federal courts to do something we all feel is a proper and good thing to do. Let's get a search warrant if we're going to be searching and seizing.
Michigan Radio's Lester Graham, he's written a couple of deeply researched and clearly stated articles on Prop 1 and Prop 2. So if you'd like to read a little bit further about these ballot measures, you can find them right now at michiganradio.org. Lester, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for today. Stateside is produced by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Our interns include Catherine Newen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.